Hello, I'm Russell Rowland, author of 56 Counties, A Montana Journey. Welcome to 56 Counties. Early on the morning of April 13th, 1918, a group of Billings residents surrounded the house of Herman Bausch, a house that still stands today, right across the street from where I live now. Bausch was a German immigrant who moved to Billings a few years earlier and started farming just outside of town. He was highly respected in Billings for being a bit of an innovator, one of the first locals to plant an orchard. But that morning, he was confronted by a mob because his name appeared on a list of Billings residents who had not yet purchased Liberty Bonds. Bausch had written in his journal, "I am opposed to war, all war that is aggressive and oppressive. But if Wall Street plutocrats insist on further bloodshed, let them finance it. Voluntarily, I will not contribute financially to this world calamity." He was not afraid to voice his opinion, and he apparently did so to someone who spread the word among the locals. The mob pressed Bausch to change his mind and buy some bonds, and when he refused, they threatened to string him up in one of the apple trees in his yard. Instead, they dragged him off to the local Elks Club, where a group of over 50 people gathered. This crowd spent several hours grilling Bausch, trying again to convince him to buy bonds, but he wouldn't budge. So he was charged under the Montana Sedition Act and sentenced to 4 years in prison. Chapter 1. Free speech. Freedom of speech has been a complicated issue in the history of America, and it has recently become a subject of controversy again. Part of what makes it complicated is that the interpretation of what free speech means depends entirely on who you ask. This question often depends on that person's definition of patriotism. Most people consider the freedom of expression to be a fundamental right that the Constitution clearly grants to its citizens. But when issues come up that threaten other aspects of American life, that freedom sometimes comes under attack, which is what happened near the end of World War I, or the Great War, as it was called at the time. When that war broke out in 1914, President Woodrow Wilson was adamant that America would not get involved. Most of the country supported him, feeling as if this was a European conflict, and that it probably wouldn't last long. In fact, Wilson won re-election in 1916 based in part on his campaign slogan, "He kept us out of the war." But events that were out of Wilson's control were beginning to sway people's opinion on the matter. First of all, the war dragged on longer than expected, so the pressure to join the fight grew from the Allies, which consisted of France, Russia, Great Britain, and later Italy. Two major events also swayed Wilson, the first of which was the sinking of the Lusitania, a British ocean liner, in May of 1915. German U-boats torpedoed the ship, killing 1,198 people, including 128 Americans. The second event was the revelation that in January of 1917, German Foreign Minister Arthur Zimmermann had carried out a secret diplomatic correspondence with the German ambassador to Mexico, proposing that if Mexico joined forces with Germany, Germany would help them regain control of Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico. Pressure on Wilson from the Allies increased as they began to wonder whether they could win the war without America's assistance. So once it became clear that we were not only under threat, but that there was a concern that the Allies would not succeed without our help, Wilson made the difficult decision on April 6, 1917, just a few months after his inauguration. He declared war on Germany. Once that decision was made, the American people's attitude toward the war changed dramatically. Theodore Roosevelt, who had been president just 10 years earlier, once stated that patriotism means being loyal to the country, not to the president. But once Wilson declared war, the line between supporting the president and supporting the country began to blur, partly by design. Within weeks of declaring war, Wilson established the Committee on Public Information, which put many journalists, speakers, and other people to work, publishing pamphlets, organizing speaking engagements, making films, and producing radio programs to sway people's view of the war. The primary focus was on supporting the war by buying Liberty Bonds, or applying for what were known as Liberty Loans, where a percentage of the interest went to the war effort. But the other more frightening part of this propaganda effort was turning Americans against each other. Chapter 2, A Mining Disaster. Even before the war, Montana had become a hotbed for labor strife, and because copper production became a vital part of the war effort, the mines in Butte were pushed way past their production limits, which led to more and more hours and less attention to safety protocols. A 1917 Department of Labor study showed that 80% of Butte residents were living in debt, and that the cost of living was higher and the wages lower than almost any other mining town in America. Although Marcus Daly was long dead and William Clark had moved to New York City to build his art collection, they had established a solid anti-union foundation in Butte, reinforcing their message by buying up nearly every paper in the state. So when the union started to raise issues about the increased work hours and dangerous conditions, the company went to work labeling them as unpatriotic. The unions were not against the war in theory so much as they were against the fact that their own labor force were the ones who would be fighting, and that they were being overworked in dangerous conditions. And of course, this was before there was overtime or medical coverage. The company would occasionally show concessions to give the impression that they were doing the right thing, but they had very little incentive to enforce the regulations. This lack of attention came to Ernest Salau, assistant foreman of the Speculator Mine, an underground copper mine, went down into the main shaft to inspect the damage done to a 3-ton cable that the mine planned to install as part of a sprinkler system. Ironically, the cable was designed to make the mine a safer place for the miners, but the cable fell as they were attempting to install it. As was often the case in those days, Salau's source of light was a carbide-burning lantern, and as he conducted his inspection, he accidentally touched a piece of oil-soaked cloth with the lantern, lighting it on fire. When he moved the lantern away from the cloth, he somehow managed to set another section of cloth on fire. Salau quickly sent John Collins, the shift boss, above ground to inform the engineers about the fire, but it was too late to stop the spread along the oil-soaked cable. For the next 3 days, crews worked nonstop trying to save lives, and they did manage to rescue several of the men trapped below. But 168 men did not survive, and to this day, this marks the largest death toll for an underground mining accident in American history. If that was all that happened, this would be a tragic and significant incident from our state's history. But as with so many stories about Montana, the events following this accident bring a whole new meaning to this disaster, which became known as the Speculator Mine Disaster or the Granite Mountain Disaster. Although the Speculator Mine was not part of Amalgamated's conglomerate, you might have expected that the executives from the mining operations in Butte and Anaconda would view this disaster as an opportunity to show how willing they were to take care of the people who work for them. Nothing could be further from the truth. One of the main reasons the workers were so angry about this incident was because so many of these deaths could have been prevented. The company had cut costs by not installing escape hatches in the concrete walls supporting the mine shafts, escape hatches that were supposed to be required. So this was just another example of a regulation that had been established but ignored. Many men died piled up against these walls, choked to death by smoke. As these details emerged, the outrage grew. Among other things, a cage of men surfaced just as the fire broke out, and men who were waiting by the opening watched as their co-workers were incinerated before their eyes. The people of Butte demanded action, but anyone reading the newspapers in Montana would not know this. The company papers reported without shame that, quote, no grievance of the workers of the Butte mines has been brought to the attention of the operators, and we believe that none exists, end quote. The union presented the Amalgamated Copper Company with a list of demands, but the company refused to even meet with them, bringing in hundreds of detectives to infiltrate the union and report activities. The main paper in Butte, the Butte Miner, stated that the solution was to round up the ringleaders who preached treason and hatred of the flag and incarcerate them. It's not hard to imagine why so much of the public was convinced by the company's rhetoric because of the war. For workers to strike while the demand for copper was high seemed self-serving. But most of the public did not know how much the company had been pushing these miners to meet that demand. Their daily wage of $4.75 was the same no matter how many hours they worked. And there were no death benefits. Workers had to pay for their own medical costs. And if a worker was killed, the family sometimes got a stipend to cover the funeral costs. But that was it. Still, the workers were portrayed as unpatriotic. Chapter 3, The Murder of Frank Little. By August, after months of no compromise on either side, some of the workers went back to work. But the IWW decided to bring in one of their most effective union organizers, Frank Little, to help rally the strikers. Little was known for his fiery speeches and his willingness to take on the most challenging cases. Just 3 years earlier, he had gone to Minnesota to support dock workers in a strike against the Great Northern Railway, and he had been kidnapped and held at gunpoint before he managed to escape with the help of union supporters. Just before he came to Butte, he had suffered another beating in Arizona where he was working with striking miners to prevent officials from rounding up strikers and shipping them off to New Mexico. Little arrived in Butte with a broken ankle and a double hernia. Frank Little was only in Butte for 2 weeks, but during that time, he managed to organize picket lines, persuaded the wives of workers to join their husbands on those picket lines, and he persuaded other trade workers to join the strike. But Little's fearlessness did him no favors in this case. The papers continued to depict his actions as anti-American rather than pro-worker. Whether he underestimated the danger he was in, or whether he was simply that devoted to the cause, someone decided he had pushed things too far, too fast. The company tried to shut Little down by going directly to District Attorney Burton K. Wheeler. Wheeler had long been a vocal opponent of the mining companies, but they appealed to him to use the Espionage Act to shut down Little's actions. But Wheeler presented them with a copy of the document and asked them to point out what actions Little had taken that violated the law. They had no answer, so Wheeler took no action. Meanwhile, the press continued to report Little's activities as treasonous. We can only speculate about who was responsible for what happened next. Little was roused from his boarding house bed in the early hours of August 1, 1917, and beaten in his room before 6 men carried him off, still in his underwear. They tied him to the bumper of a car and dragged him, scraping his kneecaps from his knees, before they drove him to a bridge just outside of town where he was hung from a trestle. A note proclaiming, quote, "Others take notice, first and last warning, 3777, was pinned to Little's underwear. The note also included the letters LDCSST with the L circled. Most assume these were the initials of union leaders who were targeted next, with the circled L indicating Little. The numbers 3777 are familiar to Montanans as the code of the Vigilance Committee, which of course led to much speculation about their involvement in the crime. Other union leaders before and after this crime also received warning notes with this code. The lynching of Frank Little was cheered around the state with people like Will Campbell, the editor of the Helena Standard, publishing an editorial that said, "Good work, let them continue to string up every IWW in the state." The sentiment was so strong that it was just a few months later that Governor Sam Stewart called a meeting that led to the Sedition Act. Little's murder was barely investigated, much less solved, but there was no shortage of rumors or of unsavory characters who were reported to have been involved, including a company thug named Billy Oates, who was known to use the hook that replaced a missing hand to beat striking minors. The coroner reportedly found a hook-sized hole in the back of Little's head. One interesting side note is that the writer Dashiell Hammett, who served as a Pinkerton detective during the strike and later utilized that experience in his novel Red Harvest, claimed that he was offered $5,000 to murder Little. Friends claimed that Hammett was always haunted by the fact that anyone would think he was willing or capable of such a thing, which brings a certain plausibility to the story. Over 13,000 people attended Little's funeral, which is still the biggest in Butte history. But this had virtually the opposite effect on the company's attitude than what a reasonable person might expect. Instead of showing any interest in solving the case or giving more consideration to the workers' demands, the company doubled down, continuing to portray the miners as the villains in the situation. The papers implied that Little had it coming, and some of the union leaders even suggested as much out of fear for their own lives. On August 18th, a rally was organized at Butte's famous Columbia Gardens, and they brought in one of Montana's most celebrated citizens, Congresswoman Jeanette Rankin, as a guest speaker. Charles Copenharve, the editor of the Anaconda Standard, was a huge admirer of Rankin, and he had received an advance copy of the speech. Copenharve called a reporter named Charles Stevens into his office and assigned him to attend the rally and report what he heard just as he heard it. Rankin delivered her speech to more than 8,000 people, telling the crowd that while she did not approve of some of the tactics of the striking miners, she found Little's murder to be inexcusable, as she did the company's policy to ignore the miners' demands. She also scolded the newspapers for portraying these striking miners as unpatriotic and called for the company to do the right thing and meet with them. Stevens wrote up the story and delivered it as promised, but to the surprise of both him and Copenharve, when they picked up the Sunday paper the next day, the story wasn't there. It had been replaced by a shorter version without any of the details of Rankin's speech. On Monday, Copenharve and Stevens both received word that Charles Eggleston, the editor-in-chief, wanted to see them. They could see from the moment they entered his office that Eggleston was upset. "Boys," he said, "I have the most unpleasant task to perform that I have ever had to do." He fired them both on the spot. Such was the power of the company. Chapter 4, Montana and Our Resources. Because so much of Montana's economy was built around mining and logging, two crucial resources for the war, Montana was quick to jump on board with the propaganda. Just 13 days after Wilson declared war, Montana Governor Sam Stewart called the first meeting of the Montana Council of Defense, an organization that was originally created to help increase agricultural production, sell war bonds, and promote enlistment. But the group quickly took on a darker agenda, compiling lists of, quote, alien residents, particularly immigrants. Germans, of course, were especially targeted. One of the great ironies of people's attitude toward the immigrants during World War I was that there had just been a huge push by the railroads through the Homestead Act to bring people west. When the war broke out, about 20% of Montana was foreign-born. The population was about 500,000 people, or less than half of what it is today, but it had grown tremendously during the early 1900s. And because of the influx of people into the state, the sense of community was not quite as strong as it had been, because people often didn't know their neighbors. From 1910 to 1920 in Montana, the number of counties grew from 9 to 51, so communities were splitting off from each other as well. As anti-German sentiment grew, German schools and papers were closed. Near Livingston, a German family's house was bombed in the middle of the night, And when the father woke up to find his wife dead next to him, he slit his throat. The perpetrators were never found. In May of 1917, Congress passed the Espionage Act, which was aimed mostly toward published works that were determined to interfere with military operations or recruitment. The enforcement of this act was left to the discretion of local United States attorneys. So there were examples of people giving the same speech in several different states before being arrested in a state that interpreted the act differently. In February of 1918, Governor Stewart called a special session of the legislature in response to a demand for stricter laws holding people accountable for their anti-war views. The result of this session was the Montana Sedition Act, an act that carried fines of up to $20,000 and a prison sentence of up to 20 years if someone were to print, utter, or publish any false, scandalous, or malicious writing about the government or the war effort. Just 3 months later, Congress passed the American Sedition Act, which was nearly word for word the same as Montana's. Because this act covered a much broader range of activities, and because it was so vaguely worded, local authorities were able to interpret it however they saw fit. In some instances, there were judges who saw the Sedition Act for what it was and were willing to go against public opinion and acquit people. These decisions sometimes led to a response from the citizens who decided to take matters into their own hands. Chapter 5, Enforcing the Sedition Act. Following the death of Frank Little, the patriotic fervor continued to grow in the form of questioning anyone who didn't express full support of the war. Communities formed councils of defense, and although these were voluntary organizations, they took their job seriously, gathering the names of people who had not purchased liberty bonds and reporting anyone who made disparaging remarks toward the war or toward America. Over the course of the 2 years following the passage of the Sedition Act, 78 men and women were convicted under the Sedition Act in Montana. By today's standards, the actions that were determined to be criminal are almost laughable. Edward Foster, a realtor in Lewistown, was overheard saying, "Because I don't carry their flag or buy their liberty bonds, I'm seen as pro-German." Again, it was all about timing. A statement that would normally draw almost no attention instead inspired a mob to drag Foster to a local pool hall and force him to carry the flag up and down the street and take an oath of allegiance. The mob wasn't done, though. They went on to the high school where they hunted up the German books in the library and burned them, then grilled the principal about whether members of his staff were loyal to the country. About 3 weeks after the Lewistown raid, the state council drew up a ban on anyone speaking German in schools and churches, and also prohibited German books from all state schools and libraries. Ben Kahn, a traveling salesman who stopped at the Pollard Hotel in Red Lodge, made the mistake of complaining about the war to a man sitting next to him, who turned out to be the owner of the hotel, but also the chairman of the local council of defense. Braun was arrested within hours of these comments and sentenced to 20 years in prison. A ranching couple near the Powder River, W.K. and Janet Smith, were arrested after W.K. called Liberty Bonds a damn graft, and Janet claimed that the government was killing off cripples and convicts in order to save money for food. Smith was sentenced to 20 years in prison, and Janet was sentenced to 10. A farmer near Bighorn named Dennis Starr was surrounded by neighbors who had heard that he hadn't bought Liberty Bonds. They insisted that he kiss the flag, which he refused to do, so he was arrested and sentenced to 20 years. Rancher Fay Rumsey was heard to say that he wished the Kaiser would come over and clean up Sarpy Creek. Rumsey was also given the maximum sentence of 20 years. Fay Rumsey had 12 children, and while he was in prison, his wife not only lost their ranch, but was too overwhelmed to take care of their children, most of whom ended up in orphanages. Many of these young people never saw each other again. But the story of Herman Rausch is perhaps the most heartbreaking because of what happened while he was in prison in Deer Lodge, about 250 miles from Billings. Rausch had become a father just a year before he was imprisoned, with his young wife giving birth to a plump little boy named Walter. Herman's journals refer to Walter as his bright-eyed boy, and photos give a good indication of why. The little guy's eyes are wide open in every picture. Herman's letters from prison showed just how enamored he was with his young son, constantly asking questions about how Walter was doing, what kind of food he liked, and whether he was frightened by thunder and lightning during storms. Sadly, about a year into Herman's imprisonment, his wife wrote to tell Herman that little Walter had died of diphtheria. Rausch submitted a request to the warden to be allowed to travel to Billings for Walter's funeral, but the warden never even bothered to respond. Chapter 6, Too Little, Too Late. Once the war ended, people came to their senses, and the Montana Sedition Act was repealed in 1921. The people serving sentences were released, but not before a lot of families suffered enormous losses, not to mention emotional damage. What it came down to in 1918 was the same thing it often comes down to, which is the fine line between patriotism and nationalism. None of the people who were convicted under the Sedition Act would be considered activists or troublemakers under normal circumstances. None of them were calling for people to rise up against American beliefs or values. They were simply opposed to having America become involved in this specific war. But the fervor that Wilson created through the Committee on Public Information made people lose sight of one of their most basic freedoms, which is the freedom to voice an opinion. In 2006, Governor Brian Schweitzer issued a pardon to everyone who had been convicted under the Sedition Act, and it was at that ceremony that several of Faye Rumsey's grandchildren met for the first time. Herman Bausch was able to return to the house across the street from where I live and continue to farm, having more children. But extreme nationalism left its mark on his life, as it did on many Montanans. As Bausch said when he was arrested, "If what I did was a crime, then there are thousands of other people in this country who are just as guilty as I am." Bausch also stated in later years that he never regretted his actions, or, as he said, my lack of action. He had stood by his principles. As Jeffrey Stone, law professor of the University of Chicago, stated in a documentary called Jailed for Their Words, When Free Speech Died in Wartime America, quote, "Recognizing the protection of free speech means acknowledging that we protect free speech, not because it's harmless, but despite the fact that it can be harmful." Devil wears red shoes, sinner. Nasty old click of them. You've been listening to 56 Counties here on Yellowstone Public Radio. I'm your host, Russell Rowland, and for this episode, I've been talking about the Montana Sedition Act of 1918, an act that led to the imprisonment of 78 Montana citizens for speaking their minds about the Great War. Thanks for joining me for this episode, and I'd like to thank my son, Fletcher, for providing some of the transitional music for this episode. Thanks to Aaron Parrott for the theme song. Join me again on the first Monday of each month for 56 Counties here on Yellowstone Public Radio.